The reading for this afternoon is 1 Kings chapter 21, verses 1 through 4. 1 Kings 21, 1 through 4. Now it came about after these things that Naboth the Jezreelite had a vineyard which was in Jezreel beside the palace of Ahab of Samaria. Ahab spoke to Naboth, saying, "Give me your vineyard that I may have it for a vegetable garden, because it is close beside my house, and I will give you a better vineyard than it in its place. If you like, I will give you the price of it in money." But Naboth said to Ahab, "The Lord forbid me that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers." So Ahab came into the house, sullen and vexed because of the word which Naboth the Jezreelite had spoken to him. For he had said, "I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers." And he lay down on his bed and turned away his face and ate no food.
In our study tonight, we're going to examine a period of history in the period of the kings, involving Ahab and some of the kings actually prior to him. And we want to notice that because the New Testament tells us that the things that were written aforetime were written for our learning. So there are many valuable lessons that we can pull from this period of time. In our studies in times gone by from the period of the kings, we've noted that, especially in this particular period, that the text is somewhat of an exciting text. If you've not read the books of 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, I would encourage you to do that. Read them together, and if you want to put them together like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we find a bit of information regarding each king that may or may not be exactly identical. We find some details in one account that you don't find in the other, and so forth. So you read these books and you put it together, and you come away with a pretty good picture of these characters of the Old Testament kings. And one of the things that I've often said about this period of time is it's exciting, more exciting than any soap opera that you would ever watch, because of the complexity of the problems and issues that they faced in their life. Most of those problems and issues that many of them faced in their life were self-made. And so the plot thickens, so to speak. But as we read in this text, we read of Ahab, Jezebel, and Naboth, in fact, in this chapter. Now, it's important, I suppose, for us to take just a moment and identify the characters that we're going to be talking about. Now, it's going to take me for a little bit to do that, because to do that, I want to set the stage of the kings. One of the things that sometimes becomes complex is trying to figure out exactly when this king reigned and that king reigned. And one of the things that we want to note is that the period of the kings sometimes is difficult in our study because certain kings are called by two or three different names. It depends on the text that you're reading. That causes some confusion. Sometimes there are different kings that have the same name. And sometimes there are different kings that are called by two or three different names. And all of that together creates some issues. But if you'll follow the text, it becomes, I think, clear who's reigning and when. And one of the things that I guess adds a little bit of complication to the mix is the way things are dated in the Scriptures. What we've got on the your left-hand side of the screen is the kings of Judah during this period of about 922 to about 843. Now keep in mind the numbers are running backwards in B.C. times. And the kings over here in Israel for that approximate same time frame. So we're pigeonholing, if you please, this time frame to see who kings were. One of the things that makes this period a little bit difficult is that you have several kings reigning here during the time that this one man reigned here, a rather lengthy period of time. Over here, as you'll note, the reign sometimes was rather short. And we're going to see that and recognize why. I have labeled on the board good kings and worst kings. Now we're going to be talking about this king. You'll note that he and Jeroboam, who was the first king of Israel, were among the worst kings that Israel had. Ahab in particular. But I find it interesting that as you read in the text, you'll find other kings as far as their wickedness is used to compare to that of Jeroboam or to Ahab. And that tells you that these were among the absolute worst that the people of Israel had. It's noteworthy just here that as we study the kings on the northern kingdom, the kingdom of Israel, there was not a single good king. It's just degrees of worse. And so this is something that we want to note. And over here we see that during the time that Asa is reigning on the throne in Jerusalem, in Judah, Asa is a good king. Jehoshaphat is a good king. And both Asa and Jehoshaphat have some interaction with King Ahab. And I think that we will see that as we go along. But to back up and to set the stage, I want us to look in 1 Kings chapter 15. I mentioned to Richard that I made a mistake this evening, and I'll just tell you that up front. We may look at some of these things very briefly because I've got more material than we're going to have time, I expect, to cover. But he said, what else is new? So as we look at the text in 1 Kings chapter 15, beginning in verse 25, we're reading about one of the kings of Israel in this time frame whose name was Nadab. Nadab was not a good king. You'll note in 1 Kings chapter 15, beginning in verse 25, there the text tells us, "And Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, began to reign over Israel in the second year of Asa, king of Judah, and he reigned over Israel 2 years." Now, it would be real easy for us, I suppose, if timekeeping was then like it is now. And we could say, this man reigned in X number of years, and here we bookend it in. But the way that it's contrasted is it tells us that so-and-so began to reign in this year of the reign of the king to the south, or to the north, as the circumstance might be. And that gets complicated sometimes for us, but so we simply want to note the character of this man, Nadab. It tells us that he did evil, in verse 26, in the sight of Jehovah, and walked in the ways of his father, and in the sin wherewith he made Israel to sin. So we've got this man identified as an evil king. We know, as you read the remainder of this context, that he was slain by Baasha. He was murdered, or Baasha was murdered by his own people. I want to call your attention to this point in 1 Kings chapter 14, if you'll back up just a little bit, that this was a matter of prophecy. In 1 Kings chapter 14, reading beginning in verse 9, 1 Kings chapter 14, beginning in verse 9. Describing this man, it tells us, "But hast done evil above all that were before thee, and hast gone and made thee other gods and molten images to provoke me to anger, and hast cast me behind thy back. Therefore, behold, I will bring evil upon the house of Jeroboam, and will cut off from Jeroboam every man child, him that is shut up and him that is left at large in Israel, and will utterly sweep away the house of Jeroboam as a man sweepeth away dung till it be all gone. Him that dieth of Jeroboam in the city shall the dogs eat, and him that dieth in the field shall the birds of the heavens eat, for Jehovah has spoken it." Verse 12, "Arise thou, therefore, get to thy house, and when thy feet enter into the city, the child shall die, and Israel shall mourn for him." Drop down, if you will, to verse 14. "Moreover, Jehovah will raise him up a king over Israel, who shall cut off the house of Jeroboam that day. But what even now? For Jehovah will smite Israel as a reed is shaken in the water, and he will root up Israel out of this good land which he gave to their fathers, and will scatter them beyond the river, because they have made their Asherim, provoking Jehovah to anger. And he will give Israel up because of the sins of Jeroboam which he has sinned, and wherewith he hath made Israel to sin." Now, I read all that to point this out, that this man is going to die. The lineage of Jeroboam, as such, is going to be cut off. Now, one of the things that we've noted, even in our history and geography study, is that from time to time, you begin a new dynasty. Now, I didn't know what a dynasty was until you kind of begin to look up some of these words, and you find that you've got father and son and grandson and so forth, and then when somebody else outside the family takes over the kingdom, now you've got the beginning of a new dynasty of kings. Now, one of the things that we noted regarding the southern kingdom, the kingdom of Judah, is there was only one dynasty of kings. We know that that promise was made unto David and extended on down through out the remainder to the time of the coming of the Lord. One dynasty of kings. That was not true big time as we look at the northern kingdom, the kingdom of Israel. Well, Baasha, and Israel died. He reigned for 24 years, killed Nadab, all the sons of Jeroboam, destroyed, fulfilled the prophecy, as you can read here in 1 Kings chapter 14. 1 Kings chapter 15, we see the ultimate fulfillment of that as far as Ahab is concerned. The prophet during this period of time was Jehu. It's noteworthy during this period of time, we'll look at this in a moment, that the enemies of God's people was Ben-Hadad of Syria at this time. And that becomes a point of politics, as we'll see in a bit. One of the things that this king did was he wanted to isolate the people from going to Jerusalem, much like others that we've studied about in times gone by. And in 1 Kings chapter 15, reading in verse 17, it says in verse 17, "And Baasha king of Israel went up against Judah and built Ramah, that he might not suffer anyone to go out or come in to Asa king of Judah." You see, there's a problem. When idolatry was introduced by Jeroboam in the beginning, you remember that Jeroboam's claim to those over whom he reigned in the northern kingdom is, "It's too much for you to go to Jerusalem and to worship there." You see, the line had been drawn between the northern and the southern kingdom. And Jeroboam introduced idolatry, and that's one of the big things that made this so much worse. And set up a golden calf in Dan and one in Bethel. And so having introduced idolatry, we see that this continues to be a practice among the northern kings. Now, Baasha, he didn't want the folks to go down there to Jerusalem, didn't want them to be subject to Asa, king of Judah. So he set up a city, Ramah, to be the city where these people were to go. Now, I mentioned that Ben-Hadad of Syria plays into this. Politics does. I want you to look at your Bible at 1 Kings chapter 15 and see Asa's response to this, beginning in verse 18. There the text tells us, "Then Asa took all the silver and the gold that were left of the treasures of the house of Jehovah and the treasures of the king's house and delivered them into the hand of his servants. And King Asa sent them to Ben-Hadad, the son of Timnah-Rimnon, the son of Hezion, king of Syria, and dwelt at Damascus," or "that dwelt at Damascus, saying, 'There is a league between me and thee, between my father and thy father. Behold, I have sent unto thee a present of silver and gold. Go break thy league with Baasha, king of Israel, that he may depart from me.'" Now, if that's not politics, I don't know what is. Here's all the gold. Here's the silver. What we want you to do is, we don't want you to be friends to Baasha anymore. We want you to be our friend. Well, Ben-Hadad was not a friend to anybody. He was a friend to himself. He was the enemy of God's people, whether it be the northern kingdom or the southern kingdom. And you can read the response of that a little bit further on in that text. But this chart identifies the city of Ramah that Baasha had set up. And we note that there was war between Asa, Baasha, and Baasha king of Israel all their days. And Baasha king of Israel went up against Judah and built Ramah that he might not suffer them to go to Asa king of Judah. That's why this city was built, to keep the people separated. Now again, do you not see politics involved in this whole picture? Baasha doesn't want to lose anyone politically. Baasha reigned, as we've noted, for 24 years. But I want to call your attention again to the text. This time turn the page to the 16th chapter. In the 16th chapter, Jehu foretold the destruction of Baasha's family. Beginning in chapter 16, in verse 3, the writer said, "Behold, I will utterly sweep away Baasha and his house, and will make thy house like the house of Jeroboam the son of Nebat. Him that dieth at Baasha in the city shall the dogs eat, and him that dieth in the field shall the birds of the heavens eat." You see that, we read it in the 14th chapter in verse 11, and you see that statement made again in chapter 21 in verse 24. But it just simply is to identify the extent of this destruction. Now, moving forward just a little bit, we know that Elah became king. And this begins the text, chapter 16, dropping down to verse 8. It says, "In the 28th year of Asa, king of Judah, began Elah, the son of Baasha, to reign over Israel in Tirzah, and reigned 2 years. And his servant Zimri," we want to note that, "captain of half of the chariots, conspired against him." Now, he was in Tirzah, drinking himself drunk at the house of Asa, or Azra, rather. Arza, I'll say that in a moment, who was over the house in Tirzah. And Zimri went in and smote him and killed him in the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah, and reigned in his stead. You see how quickly that time is passing with these kings. Elah is a bad king. He has is the son of Baasha, but Zimri, and here's the beginning of a change of dynasty. Zimri wants to be king. Now, there was a period of time in the history of Israel where it would seem that if you wanted to be king, what you did is you just killed the king that was in front of you, and then that made you king. And that's what Zimri does. I want to pass beyond that for the sake of time and notice this new dynasty that doesn't last. As you read in chapter 16, pick it up, if you would please, at verse 10. Chapter 16, verse 10. There it says, "And Zimri went in and smote him and killed him in the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah, and reigned in his stead. And it came to pass, when he began to reign, as soon as he sat on the throne, that he smote the house of Baasha. He left him not a man-child, neither of his kinfolks nor of his friends. Thus did Zimri destroy all the house of Baasha, according to the word of Jehovah, which he spake against Baasha by Jehu the prophet." Now, we just read that back up in verse 2. Now, Zimri's ambition was to be king, and in being king, he carried out the very thing that the prophet said would come to pass. Exactly what the prophet said would come to pass. Beginning this new dynasty. We want to pick up again the reading in the text where we are there at verse 13. It says, "For all the sins of Baasha and the sins of Elah, his son, which they sinned and wherewith they made Israel to sin to provoke Jehovah, the God of Israel, to anger with their vanities." Now the rest of the acts of Elah and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? Now verse 15, "In the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah, did Zimri reign 7 days." Now, he had a long reign, didn't he? It says in Tirzah, "Now the people were encamped against Gibbethon, which belonged to the Philistines. And the people that were encamped heard say, Zimri hath conspired and hath also smitten the king. Wherefore, all Israel made Omri, the captain of the host, king over Israel that day in the camp." Now look at that carefully. The people just don't like Zimri, and they make Omri king. And it says, "Omri went up from Gibbethon, and all Israel with him, and they besieged Tirzah. And it came to pass, when Zimri saw that the city was taken, that he went into the castle of the king's house, and burned the king's house over him with fire, and died for his sins which he sinned in doing that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah, and walking in the way of Jeroboam, and in his sin which he did to make Israel to sin." Now the rest of the acts of Zimri and his treason that he wrought, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? Now, I find that fascinating. Maybe that don't excite you a little bit. But this period of history where the kings are changing so rapidly, and the reason is pride, arrogancy. We're going to see a bit of that as we pursue our study just a little bit farther. But Omri, even though he now has become king, he has a rival. Verse 21, it says, "Then were the people of Israel divided into two parts. Half the people followed Tibnah, the son of Ginath, and made him king, and half followed Omri." Now, what do we have? We've got a divided kingdom, the north and the south. We've got Israel and Judah. And now in the northern kingdom, we've got another division. We've got the appointment now of two kings. Well, now we know that that's not going to work. Under the reign of Omri, the text tells us in verse 22, "But the people that followed Omri prevailed against the people that followed Tibnah and the son of Ginath. And so Tibnah died and Omri reigned. In the 31st year of Asa, king of Judah, began Omri to reign over Israel. And he reigned 12 years. 6 years reigned he in Tisra." Now, in verse 24 and following, we note that Omri's desire was to move the capital. He wants to build the city of Samaria, which is the capital of the northern 10 tribes at the time when the Assyrian king defeated them and took Samaria captive. So he built the city of Samaria. The capital has now changed, the city of Samaria. There's not a lot said about Omri. We see a little blip in Micah chapter 6, verse 16, about this king. But what we want to note is that he was very powerful politically. Politics is not new. It existed during the time of these Old Testament kings. And for the next 100 years, Israel is referred to as the House of Omri in Assyrian records. I find that interesting little tidbit, because they recognize the political power of this man who reigned only 12 years. But he made an impact in the world in which he lived. This shows us the map of where the capital was and where it was moved to, the city of Samaria, that remained the capital until 722, when the Assyrian king took the city and conquered the northern ten tribes. Now that brings us to the point of Ahab. What I want you to see is the wickedness that existed, the political power and struggle that existed to the time of Ahab. Now, you think Ahab's going to be any better? No, he just magnifies it. He makes it worse. And, of course, in the 16th chapter, picking it up at verse 28 and reading on down through a number of chapters after this, chapter 22, verse 40, is the text where we're going to be looking concerning some things about Ahab. Ahab was the son of Omri, the most wicked of these kings. Note, if you will, that Ahab married Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians. And this brings us to chapter 18, where the prophet Elijah is, of course, the prophet at this time, and he's rebuking the people for following these false gods. If you'll turn in the text, I don't want to read all of this, but I simply want to note in the context, it's doing it again, in the context of these verses, the challenge of this prophet. The prophet Elijah challenges the prophets of Baal to a contest at Mount Carmel. Of course, you know the outcome of that. The prophets of Baal did not succeed in calling upon their God to consume their offering. Thank you, Richard. And consequently, the prophets of Baal were slain. When we read about, and I have a hard time referring to this woman by any other name, old wicked Jezebel. Jezebel in the 19th chapter. It tells us, beginning in verse 1 of the 19th chapter. I didn't touch it. It says, "And Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, and with all how he'd slain all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, 'So let the gods do to me and more also, if I make not thy life as one of them by tomorrow about this time.'" Now, how does the prophet Elijah respond to that? Elijah's life is threatened. He's killed about 450 prophets of Baal and 400 of the Asherah. And so consequently, Jezebel is saying, "I'm going to kill you by this time tomorrow." And Elijah the prophet ran. The text tells us that he went to Horeb and lodged in a cave in Horeb. And God said in chapter 19, verse 9, "What doest thou here, Elijah?" Now I want to call your attention to this. Look at your Bible, verse 10. "He said, 'I have been very jealous for Jehovah, the God of hosts. For the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain the prophets with the sword. And I only am left, and they seek my life to take it away.'" Now what we've got in the text is a series of very evil kings that had not only introduced but practiced various forms of idolatry. And now King Ahab has married this wicked woman, who is, at the time that he married her, she is the son, or the daughter rather, of the Sidonian king. And she worships Baal. She's done this. This is a part of her history. Ahab is a wicked king. He worships idols. Do you think it's much of a compromise to marry this woman? Or to encourage the people to worship the gods of the Sidonians? Now, one of the things that we want to note about marriage, particularly in Old Testament times, is often marriage was a political maneuver to gain favors or support of other nations. You marry their daughters or take their sons and so forth. And this is no different. We think today often of marriage as you love somebody and you single them out and they're the only person you think in your life that's going to be for you and everything that is associated with that. And then sometimes we have problems. But can you imagine forming a marriage relationship with somebody you have no intentions of loving? It's a political arrangement. Much like many of the wives that Solomon had. Simply political arrangements. And so we have Ahab, a wicked king, marrying a very wicked woman who practiced idolatry, and he knew that. And this, of course, strengthened the political relationship between Israel and Phoenicia. Now, reading on just a little bit, I find this interesting. He took a wife, Jezebel. We're going to notice the conclusion of this quotation just a little bit further on, but I want to see it here. He took to wife Jezebel. This was the head of the and chief of his offending. He took to wife not only a pagan, but one whose hostility to the true religion was well known and carried to the utmost extent. I believe that was a quotation from Adam Clark. I should have had that on there. But let's look at who she was, what she did. Number one, she was the idolatrous daughter of an idolatrous king, the king of Sidon. She practiced it openly. It was not a concealed secret. She not only countenanced it in others, but protected it and gave its partisans honors and rewards. This is the part of the quotation. I think I do reference this at the end. She used every means to persecute those who would worship God, as you see here in the text where we noted in the 19th chapter of her opposition to Elijah the prophet. I'm going to kill him. I'll do that by tomorrow, about this time. She was hideously cruel and put to death the prophets and priests of God. Evidence of that, I think you see in the 18th chapter and in verse 4. In the 18th chapter and in verse 4, "For it was so when Jezebel cut off the prophets of Jehovah that Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50 in a cave and fed them with bread and water." Obadiah took care of them. You'll see further evidence of that in these other passages that we have listed. And all this, she did the most zealous perseverance and relentless cruelty to persecute these kings. Yes, here's the continuation of that from Adam Clark. "Notwithstanding, Ahab had built a temple and made an altar for Baal. He set up the worship of Asherah, the Sidonian Venus, which we have transformed into a grove. So well known was the hostility of Jezebel to all good that his marrying her was esteemed the highest pitch of vice and an act the most provoking to God and destructive to the posterity of the kingdom." Now that's a long quotation from Adam Clark, but he's got that nailed. This was one wicked woman. She had no ounce of good in her. And we're going to see the result of that as our study progresses. Baal worship then became the official religion of Israel. Is it any wonder? From such a wicked source. Jericho. I've got to stop and pause on this note because it's just that important. And in this context, Jericho, we know, was destroyed by the people of Israel when they entered into the Promised Land. It was the first city of conquest in Joshua chapter 6. But we know that in accord with the prophecy of Joshua, the city was not to be rebuilt. If it was to be rebuilt, then the man that rebuilt it would lose his firstborn and his secondborn or lastborn sons. Now, that's prophesied, and you can read about that in Joshua chapter 6, beginning in verse 26, when they first came in and took the land. But now in our text here of 1 Kings chapter 16, in verse 34, it tells us, "In his days did Hiel the Bethlehemite build Jericho. He laid the foundation thereof with the loss of Abram, his firstborn, and set up the gates thereof with the loss of his youngest son, Segub, according to the word of Jehovah, which he spake by Joshua the son of Nun." Now that's during this time frame that we're talking about when Ahab became king. This is what's going on in the nation of Israel. Assyrian records record some of the conflict involving Ahab and king of Assyria, Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, Ben-Hadad. Now, what was the consequence of the things that Ahab is doing? His wickedness and that of old wicked Jezebel. Israel was punished by a 3-year drought. In 1 Kings chapter 17, we began to read about that. We have reference of that in James chapter 5 regarding the power of prayer and the prayer of a righteous man. Elijah, 1 Kings chapter 18, as we've mentioned, engaged in the contest with the prophets of Baal and Asherah. Elijah fled. Jezebel threatens his life on that chart. Ben-Hadad and the Syrians besieged Samaria. This is an interesting bit of history in this connection. In chapter 20, beginning in verse 1, Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, gathered all his host together, and there were 32 kings with him, and horses and chariots and so forth, and he besieged Samaria, chapter 1. Now, to make a long story short, he was not successful. He attempted to defeat the city of Samaria, but God spared the city. They were not, at this point, defeated. Continuing just a little bit further, Ahab has opportunity to kill Ben-Hadad. And in chapter 20, verse 42, he's rebuked because he didn't take advantage of that opportunity. He let him get away. Now, again, we underscore this. And that brings us to our point. 1 Kings chapter 21. Where Ahab says to Naboth, I want your vineyard. It's right next to my house. I want to make a garden out of it. I like your vineyard. Now, what we want to note here is the response of Naboth. He said, I can't do that. And the reason that I can't do that in verse 3 of chapter 21 is, this is my inheritance. You recall when they came into the land was divided among the families of Israel. And the land was to be retained by the descendants to whom that was assigned. And Naboth said, I can't give you my family inheritance. I can't do that. I can't sell it. And Jezebel says, don't worry about that, honey. I'll take care of him. Now, that's Mick's very brief paraphrase. And that's what she did. And I want to call your attention to what she did. She found false witnesses to lie about Naboth, so that Naboth would be killed and the vineyard would belong then to her husband. But while we're thinking on that, let's look at the consequences for Ahab and Jezebel. In 1 Kings chapter 21, you'll notice in verse 19, the writer says, And thou shalt speak unto him, saying, Thus saith Jehovah, Hast thou killed and also taken possession? Well, yes, that's what they did. They killed Naboth and took his possession. And thou shalt speak unto him, saying, Thus saith Jehovah, In the place where the dogs lick the blood of Naboth, shall dogs lick thy blood, even thine. Now we know that was partially fulfilled during the lifetime, or I should say during the death time, of King Ahab in 1 Kings chapter 22, in verses 37 and 38, the last chapter, 37 and 38. It says, So the king died and was brought to Samaria, and they buried the king in Samaria, and they washed the chariot by the pool in Samaria, and the dogs licked up his blood. Now the harlots washed themselves there, according to the word of Jehovah which he spake, and the rest of the acts of Ahab and all that he did. And the ivory house which he built, and all the cities that he built, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? So Ahab slept with his fathers, and Ahaziah his son reigned in his stead. Now I said that this was prophesied. This is what's going to happen to Ahab. Here we read that's exactly what happened to Ahab. I said it was fulfilled in part when it happened to Ahab. But you remember one of the things was that the house of Baasha was going to be cut off. Not going to be any descendants from him. As you read on concerning Ahab, the text tells us in 2 Kings chapter 9. 2 Kings chapter 9. You'll turn there with me. 2 Kings chapter 9. And let's read verse 26. 2 Kings 9, verse 26. There the text tells us, beginning at verse 24, Jehu drew his bow with his full strength and smote Joram or Jehoram. Again, I said that some of the things that get difficult in this time period is kings that are called by different names. And this is the case with Jehoram or here Joram. The text tells us that Jehu drew the sword and smote Joram between his arms.
And the arrow went out at his heart, and he sunk down into the chariot. Then said Jehu to Bidkar, his captain, take up and cast him in the portion of the field of Nabal the Jezreelite. For remember how that when I and thou rode together after Ahab his father, Jehovah laid this burden upon him. Surely I have seen yesterday the blood of Naboth and the blood of his sons, saith Jehovah, and I will requite thee in this plat, or in this portion, saith Jehovah. Now therefore take and cast him into the plat of ground according to the word of Jehovah. Now that just happened just like God said. Now that helps us to understand the power and validity of what these prophets had to say. The dogs would lick up his blood. Well, it did those who descended from him, as his house was cut off, fulfilling this prophecy in 2 Kings chapter 9 and in verse 26. Now, let's talk just a moment about Naboth. Powerful lesson about this man. Naboth was a good man. His responsibility is to keep his land, not sell it. It's his inheritance given by Jehovah. You can't have my vineyard. He's simply doing what God had instructed him to do. Naboth was a good man. But what happened to this good man? We know in 1 Kings chapter 21 that these false witnesses lied about him. In verse 13 it says, and two men, base fellows, came in and sat before him. And the base fellows bare witness against him, even against Naboth, in the presence of the people, saying, Naboth did curse God and the king. Well, did Naboth curse God and the king? No, he didn't do that. But did it cause him not to have to suffer the consequences? And one of the things just here, brethren, that we need to learn is that these evil people that we're reading about really don't have a conscience. Do you see that? Killing Naboth was nothing. Jezebel said, I'm going to take care of that. I'll get his vineyard. So she hired men to lie about him. Naboth, a good man. One that was attempting to serve God and keep the portion that was his inheritance according to the law of God. Naboth, a good man, died at the hands of these people that lied. Now, that's not uncommon, is it? We saw that in our Acts study in Acts chapter 6 concerning Stephen. And we see that false charges were brought before Felix regarding the Apostle Paul in Acts chapter 25. False charges, many grievous charges were brought against him. But just because you're trying to do what's right does not mean that everything that's going to happen to you is always going to be good. Just not that way. Sometimes we reason that way. Well, where did I mess up? What kind of mistake did I make that brought this evil upon me? Sometimes good people suffer at the hands of those who are wicked, and we see that characteristic of Naboth. He suffered at the hands of these wicked people. In fact, the Hebrew writer alludes to that a number of times. In the 11th chapter of the book of Hebrews, in verse 37, it says, they were stoned, they were sawn asunder, they were tempted, they were slain with the sword, they went about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, of whom the world was not worthy. These were good men. Men of faith. But look at how they were treated. Stephen was killed, stoned to death. Paul, they thought they killed him in Acts chapter 14, as we've been studying in our Acts study. So we want to talk about Naboth and note that here's a good man, a very conscientious man, that died because of his convictions at the hand of those who were very, very wicked. Ahab, his lineage was cut off, as we read. No descendants, fulfilling the prophecy. And an interesting note, if you want to read further in 2 Kings chapter 9, he had 70 sons. And they were ordered to be killed, and their heads were placed in a basket, made two piles, the entrance into the city. Now I tell you, if you had 70 sons, and you realized you'd messed up, and now here's the consequence, and the people see this as the consequence. Here are the heads of your sons. You think that'd make any kind of an impact on you, you see? What Jeroboam did led to the cutting off of his lineage, and what Ahab did led to the cutting off of his lineage, just like we've discussed concerning Baasha and his sins in the 16th chapter. Now, Jezebel. In 1 Kings chapter 21, look again at verse 23. And Jezebel also spake, saying, the dogs shall eat, and of Jezebel also Jehovah spake, the dogs shall eat Jezebel by the rampart of Jezreel. Him that dieth of Ahab in the city, the dogs shall eat, and him that dieth in the field shall the birds of the heavens eat. So the same thing that happened to Jezebel was fulfilled a bit later on. Same thing that happened to Ahab was fulfilled a little bit later on. Jezebel outlived Ahab about 14 years, but she died just the same. And Richard, as we sometimes speak of Jezebel, who is on the Lord's side, and some said, well, we are, and they flang her down. And they flang her down 70 times 7. That's not the case, but point being, she was killed, and they ran over her body with the chariot, and while others were eating, the dogs came and ate everything but the palms of her hands. So here we have the blood of Jezebel licked up by the dogs, just as the prophet said. I want to pass beyond that chart for just a moment, if you would permit me, and get to this prophecy. Micaiah prophesies of Ahab's death. Ahab was slain in battle, 1 Kings 22. The dogs licked up his blood, as we talked about. Now, as we look at the lessons from all of these wicked kings, bad decisions that they made. Number one, God had told these people, do not intermarry with the heathen nations. Don't do that. And we saw that Solomon did that, and it created issues. We've seen that many kings did that, and here is a sample of that. The lesson gleaned then is, be careful who you marry. We note that Ananias and Sapphira in the New Testament, they kind of fed off each other, if I may use that terminology. They had conspired together to lie to God about their contribution to those who were in need in Jerusalem. You'll also note the vivid warning of the Apostle Paul, take heed. Take heed. Why? Because evil companions corrupt good morals. You be careful of the people you choose to be your friends. Take heed. Be not deceived. Don't be deluded into thinking, well, I can always change. No, not every time. You might reason and say, well, I can change this person. Don't start down that path. You be careful who you marry. The warning is to those who are doing what's right. Be not deceived. Evil companions corrupt good morals. Also fulfill your proper role. Beware of being selfish. When we look at old Ahab, Ahab was to be the king. Wicked though he was to be king. Jezebel's place was not to be the king. She was the queen. Another thing that we want to note is beware of selfishness. We don't always get everything we want. I think one of the most vivid lessons that we read in this is the reaction of Ahab when Naboth tells him, I cannot sell you my vineyard. He turned his face to the wall and he pouted. That's what he did. You see, that's not anything new, is it? He pouted because he didn't get his way. And therefore, Jezebel said, don't worry, honey, I'll take care of it. Life is not always fair, brethren. In Ecclesiastes chapter 9, beginning in verse 11, we learn that the race is not always to the swiftest. Everything is not always evenly balanced. So when we look at the inequities involved in life, don't sit down and pout. That don't fix the problem. We see that with Ahab. His desire to have something that he ought not have. In the chart that we skipped, we noticed that Ahab supposed repentance. But he didn't stop worshiping the idols. He didn't bless the people of God. His repentance was very short-lived, if at all. And notice, if you will, there are always consequences. Even though Ahab was king, there were consequences to be meted out. He could not avert those consequences because he continued to practice the things that were wrong. Now, one of the things that we've noted just in the reading of the text, here's the prophecy. And we've noted time involved between the time of the prophecy and the fulfillment of it. In fact, we noted that Ahab was indeed slain, and the dogs came and licked his blood. Jezebel lived 14 years beyond that. Exact same thing that the prophet said would come to pass happened with her too. The dogs came and licked up her blood. What we want to see is that God always does what He says. He always does what He says. He never defaults on anything. And these are just a few of some very valuable lessons, I think, that we can see from this very interesting period of Old Testament history, the period of the kings. If you've not taken the time to read from the Kings and the Chronicles, you should do that. And note the parallel passages from each one. It's an exciting period of history. And again, we know that these things were written for our learning. How can we learn the lessons if we don't read from the text, see the history, and make the application of the lessons learned? You've listened patiently, and I appreciate you sharing with me my interest in this period of Old Testament history. Perhaps I'm talking to someone who has been thinking about obedience to the gospel. Friend, you need to go beyond just thinking about it, because your relationship with the Lord is one of separation if you're not yet in Christ. You need to take heed to that. Believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. Turn from your sin and repentance. Confess your faith. And be baptized into His death so that you can be raised to a new life. If you've done that and you've not lived faithfully, beloved, it's been a grand day today to see two that desire to do the things that are right, want to correct wrong and live a more righteous life, one that's acceptable to the Lord. You can do that tonight. If we can help you to obey the Lord, then make that known while we stand and sing this song.